Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 27th, 2021. Wow. And I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria, and we have a great one for you this week. I'm so excited. But before we dive in, I do want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is made possible from the generous support of listeners just like you. If you would like to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy to learn more. This week's top patrons at the very tippy top is Rob Schreck, along with Daniel Lang and Mary Neva. I also want to thank Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ for their support of the show, among many, many, many others. Right now, 212 of you. Thank you all so, so much from the bottom of my heart. Okay, let's get into it. This week, I had the distinct honor of having my favorite living science writer on the show. If you don't know her, you absolutely should. Her name is Mary Roach, and she is the author of, let's see if I can do this, Stiff, Spook, Grunt, Gulp, Packing for Mars, Bonk, and her newest, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. We're going to talk about all things writing, all things human-animal conflict, all things cadaver, all things the alimentary canal, and more. So you don't want to miss it. Without any further ado, here she is, Mary Roach. Mary, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk with you about all things Mary Roach, but of course, equally and including your newest book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. So it's very rare on Talk Nerdy that I have had the, let's say the time, the energy, because I'm, you know, I'm doing a million things at once, working on my PhD, doing a TV show. I work on multiple podcasts. It's very rare that I've had the time and the energy to like read the book. It's even more rare when I have an author on whose books I have read all of, but I have to say, and this is, I know this is going to sound really weird up front because we just started recording, but I've told a lot of other people this, and when I say it, I'm not blowing smoke. It's absolutely true. You're my favorite living science writer.
Oh, thank you so much.
I find your style of writing to be so compelling. So it's like you manage to be incredibly informative. I learn so much when I read from you, but at the same time, there isn't an ounce of haughtiness. There isn't an ounce of teacheriness. These are not words. I'm not a writer, as you can tell.
I like teacheriness. I like that. Teacheriness.
they're so, like, your words are very humble. They're also very confronting in a way. Like when I read your work, I am thrown into the questions that at my core, at my soul, I would have wanted to ask, but most people don't because they're maybe not always the polite questions, if that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense. I don't seem to have any boundaries. I have no sense of shame. I will ask anybody anything. And, but, you know, it's funny. People, it's almost like they're like, thank God somebody asked this question. I can finally let it out.
Do you ever run into people, though, who are really taken aback and are kind of like, oh, I can't talk about that?
I do remember being in an operating room with a surgeon who was, I don't remember what procedure I was witnessing or where I was, but he was using one of those laser scalpels that kind of cut and seal at the same time. And of course, they're burning the flesh as they do this. And I said, Do you think that kind of smells good? The smell. And he said, that is a really morbid question. And I was so taken aback because I was like, really? It is? I don't know. I guess someone needs to recalibrate my sensors because I just thought it was, I don't know. It kind of smelled good.
Of course. I mean, meat is meat, right? No matter right? the source. Right.
It smelled like a barbecue in there.
Exactly. Oh, that's funny. Yeah. And I mean, I can imagine that very, very often, like you said, it runs the gamut everywhere from people who are like, oh, thank God somebody finally asked me that. This is what I really want to talk about. This is what I talk about with my friends after work. Up to kind of like, wow, you really put me on the spot here, Mary. Thank you. Because you go there and I don't know, like there's so many questions I want to ask you. And I probably honestly should have prepared for this interview more, but I told myself, you're going to fangirl a little and then you're just going to go. You're just going to talk. And so, you know, I don't have any questions scripted for you. I just want to see what comes up.
Yeah, sure.
But I think one of the kind of biggest questions that I've been sitting on is, how do you decide what these topics are going to be? You know, all the way from your first book, which was the book that really, I mean, it continues to stick with me and probably many of your other readers, Stiff. Stiff was first, right?
Stiff was first. Yep. Yep. It's just been re-released because it's been out, what is it, almost 20 years. So we re-released it and I did an epilogue to bring it up to date, kind of did some additional reporting. But yeah, that was Stiff was my first book. And people, you know, when it's your first book, people, they're like really excited. I wrote for magazines for years. People are like, oh my God, you're writing a book. That's so exciting. What's it about? cadavers. And you know, people and people would have several reactions, none of them very pleasant. They'd either just get away from me quickly. One of them went, well, let me ask you something. Who's going to buy this book? Her name was Bonnie. I forget her last name. Fluke, Bonnie Fluke. And she's like, let me ask you, at a party. So, and on the cover of Stiff that just came out, it says over 1 million copies sold. So that's for you, Bonnie Fluke. That's who. Screw you, Bonnie Fluke. Of course, she's going to listen to this and she's going to be like, wow, that was uncalled for. What a bitch.
Oh my God, I love it. But it's true. It's like there is this, and you managed to tap so beautifully into the morbid, quote, morbid curiosity of kind of human nature, of sort of like our existential selves. In a way, though, and I know that I've said this to you before, and I've said this about you before, probably on air, in a way that is like bitingly funny, but in the very same breath, ultimately respectful. And that's a really hard thing to do because it's very easy to like punch down. It's very easy to be funny, but also to kind of take the piss in a way. And
like I just did to Bonnie Fluke.
Oh, exactly. Bonnie, we love you, Bonnie. But it's, you know, especially with a book like Stiff, where you're talking about dead bodies, yes. And you're talking about what happens, you know, if you donate your body to science. In a book like Spook, where you're talking about people trying to seriously and really earnestly experiment on the concept of an afterlife, right. Which, you know, doesn't usually end the way that they would maybe hope.
Right.
Where you're talking, you know, in Grunt, where you're talking about military individuals who, you know, probably many of whom have a great sense of humor, but are not known for having the best right. sense of humor. Right. You know, these are very sensitive areas, but oftentimes authenticity requires that we grapple with the absurd. But you manage to grapple with the absurd in a way that ultimately is so respectful of the dead. It's so respectful of the victim. It's so respectful of the, quote, perpetrator, if there's a perpetrator. It's so respectful of the scientists and the subject of the science. And I'm always taken aback by that when I read your work.
Well, that's really great to hear because I actually lose a fair amount of sleep over that because I do choose these topics that are a little bit sensitive or taboo. And I like to have fun and kind of make people laugh, but I don't ever want to be hurtful. Well, sometimes there's every now and then there's a character in the book. I'm like, I'm just going to let you have it here.
Yeah.
there's like one per book.
Right. Like you should not have been such an asshole because you are so getting written into this book.
Yeah. You had it coming. So, but for the most part, I want the people that I've written about, if they're still alive, some of it is historical, but I want them to like the book. I don't want them. I mean, obviously it's not a fluff piece. I'm not writing a publicity campaign for them, but I don't want them to feel angry or that they've been slighted or betrayed in any way, but I still want it to be entertaining. So I spend a lot of time fretting about that. And I'm always very, I have a lot of dread when the book comes out and the people who are in the book, like what are they going to think? Like the thing that makes me most happy when a book comes out, is not a good review in a newspaper. It is a letter, an email from somebody in the book who I've profiled saying that they enjoyed it. It's a huge relief, just a huge relief. Cause you never know how people are going to respond to how they're portrayed. And it is this, you know, they're trusting you with their career in a way, you know? And it's very generous. There's nothing really in it for them. They're not getting paid for their time. They're not, it's just they're agreeing to let me step into their world, eat up their time, and let me, you know, portray them without really knowing what I'll do. Lately, I have been, I often read the chapter out loud to somebody. So just mostly to make sure it's accurate. You never know. So I'm always bracing for the worst. So part of my success, I think, comes from massive insecurity. Do I have this right? Do I need to tweak a little more? Does this need to be funny? Does this need to be more, there needs to be a little more pathos here? But for the most part, it's just intuitive. You know, by the time you finish reporting a book, you spend at least a couple of years immersed in this world, and you have sort of an intuitive feel for what you're going to get at, how you're going to say it, and what's appropriate. And you just have to trust that because there's no real formula for it.
Right. And there's no real formula. There's no right or wrong. I mean, you're developing it as you go. I'm curious, two things, which I probably won't remember both by the time we finish the first. But the first is, you know, how do you determine what you want to make book length? You know, like you said, before Stiff and after, you were writing for, you know, these different outlets and, you know, any sort of freelance writer or even staff writer has had the experience of, okay, I've got a 500 word assignment, I've got a 3000 word assignment, I've got, you know, these different things in between. And so this topic requires this amount of reporting and blah, blah, blah. But book length is a whole different animal. And you've written, you know, multiple book length topics, some of which feel very broad, like cadavers, right? Like what happens to your body when you die, or your new book, Fuzz, like what happens when nature steps out of some arbitrary line that humans have imposed on them, versus some topics feel really narrow. And I was amazed by how much content there was, like gulp. Okay, we're talking mouth to butthole.
Right.
What's going on here?
Right.
And there were, I mean, I was just, it was a joyful experience from mouth to butthole as I was reading gulp, because there was so much there that I had no idea about. So,
So how do
you decide that?
How do I decide that? Well, for many years I didn't write books for that very reason, because I was used to writing 4,000 words or 5,000 words at most. And the idea of writing 80,000 words on a topic seemed ridiculous. Like what would that be? But my topics are they're so broad that they enable me to kind of cherry pick, say 12 to 15 different aspects of this very broad topic to fill up the chapters. And you know, and they're linked. There definitely is a progression from one to the next, but they also kind of stand alone a little bit. So they're almost like 15 separate topics under an umbrella topic, you know? So that makes it a little easier. I mean, it's never easy for me to figure out the book topic. I often start with one item that kind of intrigues me. And I think, what would be the umbrella that would, what would be the umbrella topic that would cover this? You know, I'll start with a very specific thing and then build out from there. I'm like this, there used to be this ad for Kohler bathroom fixtures. You know, they make faucets and shower heads. And there's this ad, this ridiculous ad where this man walks into an architect's office and he plunks down a Kohler faucet on the architect's desk and he goes, "Build a house around this."
I remember that.
I'm like, what an asshole. Wow. The architect must be like, get out of my, just leave right now. But anyway, I'm kind of like the asshole with the faucet, because I'll just find something that is just so compelling and interesting and surprising. I'll think, oh, this could be in a book. What would that book be? And then I kind of move out from there and try to see what other faucets, what other plumbing fixtures could I throw into the mix. So it's not like I start with a topic. I kind of start with a piece of a book and figure out what the book would be. So it's a kind of a weird inside out journey for me. And it's always the hardest part of the process is figuring out what the next book will be. I mean, I did that with Stiff also. I'd been wandering around the basement of the UCSF Medical School Library, and I came across the STAP car crash conference proceedings from 1960s, sometime in the 60s, you know, span of a decade, and was looking through them. And there were all these bizarre, you know, these studies trying to develop. It was the dawn of automotive safety. And in order to figure out what car, you know, what were cars doing to people, they used cadavers initially in order to create the dummies that we now use. So I wrote a short piece on that, and people seemed to respond to that and find it interesting. So that was kind of me going, well, I don't know, careers of the dead, like interesting things you can do when you're dead. That was sort of the genesis, just wandering around and finding this bizarre collection of bound papers from the car crash conferences of the 60s. And then thinking, well, so cadavers, what other interesting hobbies and careers have they had? How have people used them? And then it just grew from there. And eventually I threw a book proposal together. So it wasn't like I thought one day, cadavers, that's a great book topic, because I actually agreed with Bonnie Fluke. Who the hell is going to buy this book? I had the same thought, which is probably why it was so painful to hear that. Because it doesn't seem obvious that someone's going to walk into a bookstore, point to a book about cadavers, you know, on a table full of new nonfiction and go, oh yeah, that one, that's the one I want to read. So,
but you do, you tap into something that's maybe not obvious, but is so there in most people's minds. And
sure, we all end up there.
Yeah. And you take that kernel and you grow it into something, you know, large and probably at times that feels unwieldy, but ultimately ends up feeling incredibly intentional and incredibly planned. And I'm wondering, what is that kernel for your new book, Fuzz? What kind of inspired you? What experience did you have that inspired you to say, okay, this is a topic, like, yeah, when nature quote, yeah, breaks, well, the law.
I started out, well, I go through this period of kind of grasping and groping, kind of figuring out where might I go next? And as part of that grasping and groping, I had stumbled onto some of this work being done up in Ashland, Oregon at the National Wildlife Forensics Laboratory. I mean, I like forensics. Forensics is interesting. It's been covered a lot in human crime. But I got fascinated by the work that's done there trying to, you know, because endangered species get trafficked, the whole animal, parts of the animal, et cetera. And there's this woman up there, another Bonnie Yates. She's retired now, but Bonnie Yates has this hair library, you know, which, you know, for different species.
Like you do.
Yeah. It's a hair library that, of course, appealed very much to my sensibility, the hair library. So, you know, and she was talking about how complicated it is because any one species has, you know, they've got regular hair, undercoat, guard hair, whiskers. So to put together, I mean, a comprehensive library of all. Anyway, that was kind of interesting. She wrote a paper on how to tell real versus counterfeit dried tiger penis, 8-page paper. on that. And so I just thought, well, let me just see what Bonnie Yates is about and whether this could be the faucet, the Kohler faucet. And unfortunately, as I was told by the director of the lab, you cannot tag along on any open investigations. You cannot shadow our investigators because that's illegal. So that was a dead end. And then I wandered off. And then, you know, I thought, well, maybe I can use some of this material and then I'll combine it with something else. I wandered off into the world of agricultural crime because I got interested in the fact that before the Super Bowl, so many people want to make guacamole that there's this whole black market and people stealing avocados from avocado ranches. And to the extent that there's a felony crime called grand theft avocado, that is actually a category. So I kind of got interested in agricultural crime. That was a dead end because honestly, it's not that interesting. People stealing fruit. And then it's never a tidy process. I never have a tidy origin story. But then eventually I kind of thought about, well, what if wildlife were the perpetrators rather than the victims? And I found out that there is a whole branch of science called human-wildlife conflict with, you know, conferences and textbooks and people spending their entire career trying to sort out these problems between wildlife and humans. And so I thought, well, that's an interesting corner of science that I didn't know about. So I started looking into it, and that also had the idea to organize it by crime, starting with the felony crimes, murder, manslaughter, home invasion, breaking and entering, grand theft sunflower seed for the blackbirds, and then the misdemeanors, littering, trespassing, jaywalking. And all of them involve some kind of science or some aspect of this, which is was kind of fun. So that's kind of how it happened. Very long, meandering, not all that interesting story.
Incredibly interesting. And I mean, I think it's, they call it in the psychology world or in the psychotherapy world, the difference between like content and process. So when I'm working with a patient, there's what they say, and then there's like what this aspect of the conversation, not necessarily what it means, because I'm not Freudian. I'm not saying like a cigar is not a cigar, but it's sort of like, you know, they're saying these words about this stressor. We're working on developing good strategies to overcome or to mitigate their, you know, panic disorder or whatever the case may be. And so there's the content and there's the process. And I find that probably listeners to my podcast know that there's a lot of talk about process. I think that process is really fundamental. I also think it's something we don't often get to hear about. We're so used to short form journalism, or especially in audio and video formats, pithy sound bites. You know, this is the headline, this is the main takeaway, with no nuance, no context, no anything. And so I love to dig deep into the why and the how of everything. And I personally think it is very interesting. And I remember my second question that was at the tip of my tongue. I'm very excited, which was, what part excites you more? And of course, this is not a binary. I'm sure they're both interesting to you, but you do a lot of, you know, in the field, boots on the ground reporting for your books. Like, you go to where the action is, you discuss things with people, and you really try to dig deep and understand things so that we, as the observers, as the readers, as the listeners, can empathize, you know, kind of put ourselves in your shoes. But you also do a lot of really cool, like, archival historical reporting. And I'm wondering which of those is more compelling for you? Which of those do you find you are, you know, excited more to dive into? Which of those do you enjoy writing about more? I'm sure it's, you know, it's kind of all over the map, but they're so different, these forms of reporting. And I think they coalesce together really beautifully.
Oh, well, thanks. But for me, the writing, how much I enjoy the writing depends entirely on how well the reporting went. So,
okay.
And likewise, the reporting is only joyful if it's going well. If I'm getting, you know, a scene or a moment that I know is going to be really fun to write up for the reader. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a fun moment. Sometimes it's awkward or disgusting or risky or embarrassing, but I know it'll be fun to write, so I don't care. So that is still a really positive reporting experience for me.
Interesting. You know, sorry to interject, but I can imagine that it would, you know, I'm trying to empathize with your job right now. And I'm thinking, I naively would probably always get so caught up in this is a fascinating experience or this is a fun experience that it would be hard for me to constantly remind myself this is all about what's going to end up in the book and whether this is, you know, good reporting or not, or it lends itself to good reporting or not, that's what matters.
Yep.
I think I might be like, that was a great day. And then I'm like, shit, I don't think any of this is useful.
Yeah. There's nothing duller than a fun trip. You know, no one wants to hear about your fun trip where everything went well and you had a nice time at the beach and you had some good food. Nobody cares.
Nobody wants to see those slides.
People want to hear about, you know, when you fell overboard and, you know, you were attacked by sharks or whatever. They want to hear about the parts where there was some drama. So, you know, when I was writing the Packing for Mars, which had to do with living without gravity, living in space, and NASA would sometimes go like, you know, let's get you down here to ride the rover, you know, and okay, that'd be kind of cool. All right, a rover. I'm like, but it doesn't, that is so not interesting for a reader. I'm on the rover now where it's kind of like a golf cart and we're driving around. God, who cares? It's like, let's get you here to ride. No, I don't want to ride your rover. I think I might have been asking, like, I'm doing a chapter on restricted hygiene and what it's like to not bathe for weeks. And when there was all kinds of research back in the Gemini and Apollo era. And I said, I really want to come there when the shuttle, when there were shuttle flights, when the shuttle lands, I want to be there just to, when they open the door, just to sniff it. Can I sniff the inside of the shuttle after the mission? You know, and they're like, no.
Absolutely not, crazy lady.
No, you can't sniff the shuttle. You know, maybe like, why don't you come down and you can ride the rover? Screw you and your rover. I don't want to ride the rover. I want to sniff the shuttle. So, yeah. So the writing then, it is satisfying and fun only if the reporting went well.
Right.
Have to try to salvage a chapter because the trip wasn't all that interesting. And you know, you can spend a week somewhere and maybe there'll be 5 minutes that were a really interesting scene that you know you can write up. And then that's a successful trip, even though days went by where really, even though you're taking notes in your head, you're like, boring, 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 boring. I could just be writing that on my notepad over and over. Boring, boring. But eventually, you know, some moment will happen where the core of this person and their passion comes through, or my own ignorance is juxtaposed against their incredible braininess, and our inability to communicate is sometimes interesting. So it doesn't have to be sexy or dangerous or, you know, for it to work, but there have to be a few of those moments. A couple of those moments is all you need for the narrative, you know, two scenes, and then you can kind of, that's your scaffold, and you can hang onto that the other information that you're finding in your reporting. But, you know,
if you had to come up with, like, and this is probably an impossible question to answer, but like an efficiency quotient in terms of sort of like the amount of time and energy and effort you put into like doing field reporting and the percentage of, you know, valuable content you get versus the amount of time you spend poring, like, you know, when we were talking about the archive work, poring over periodicals and, you know, archives and libraries and things versus, you know, the gold that you mine out of it, which one do you think would be more efficient?
Well, I can tell you that less than 5% of what I end up using, less than 5% of what I'm taking notes on and photocopying and gathering in my reporting. I would say 5%.
Both in the field and in an archive setting?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
wow. Yeah. I mean, an archive, especially if you don't quite know where to look, you may be just going through 100 folders, finding nothing. But that is actually kind of a fun process, snooping through old archives, because they're just the language of how letters were written and the way, you know, memos were filed with, you know, what was it, carbon paper to make the copies?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, like just, in triplicate.
Yeah, in triplicate, and secretaries initialing things, and, you know, top secret secret stamps on things that have been, you know, declassified, and but that used to say secret on them. Just that kind of,
and like dictated but not read.
Yeah. Stuff like that. So you're just stepping back into the 1940s or whenever. And that is fun in and of itself, even if you're not always finding the material that you need. But then when you do find what you need, it's just, I mean, it's, you know, my heart rate goes up. It's so satisfying, especially if you've been slogging along thinking, I'm never going to find anything. And then you find it, you know, it's like the nugget of gold. I can imagine if you're a miner or a whatever, the people who did that thing at the river. What are they, panning for gold?
I don't know. The panner.
The panner, the guy with the beard and the beat up hat. Yeah, that guy standing at Civ guy, standing at squatting in the river. That guy, it's like you suddenly find the, you know, a sizable piece of gold and you're like, yee-haw!
You know, I'm curious, and I don't know why this just came to me, but it's like, it's really boring into my brain now. Probably because my last three or four guests on the show, I've been doing this podcast now for like 7+ years. And each week I interview either a scientist or a science writer generally about their little corner of the universe. you know, so I've covered the gamut from every, you know, science, technology, engineering, math field I can think of to lately, because of my work in psychotherapy, I identify as, I'm trained in the orientation of existential psychotherapy. I work with cancer patients, and specifically, I very much enjoy my work in death and dying, and kind of grappling with bigger issues like mortality. So I've been sort of, and I'm very social justice oriented in my approach. And so some of the frame of my show has shifted a little bit. I'm saying all of this as context for the fact that probably my last like four guests were women of color who are, you know, big social justice advocates who are grappling with like really big inequities and big conversations about how society is run. And all of that is to say, you know, when you write your books from a reader's perspective, there's a sort of, it's equally earnest and, like I said, absurd. It's equally, you know, hilarious, but also respectful. But there's also and I hope you take this as a compliment, because I absolutely mean it as one, but like a sort of wonder and almost like a naive wonder to them. That's not to say you're naive, but your approach to these topics is often like, tell me literally everything. I want to know all the weird stuff. And I'm wondering, do you ever grapple personally with having an agenda, having a point of view, having a, you know, a social justice point of view, or a real kind of personal limit or perspective, and either fighting against it or maybe saying, I want this to come out in my writing because I think it's important that people think about things from this perspective, because historically we haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. There are times when I stumble onto something in that realm of social justice and it is off topic, essentially. There was a situation in Fuzz where I was reporting in India about how elephant attacks, killings by elephants are dealt with. And it's an interesting situation, partly because elephants are part in their religion. There's an elephant god, Ganesh. So the elephant has these associations, and so there's kind of a reverence for these animals, and, you know, in general, animals that are in that kind of the collection of gods are treated fairly nicely. The elephants are given a sort of a retirement. They work, if they're working in the timber industry or wherever they're working, They get a pension in the form of housing and food, and they're bathed daily and massaged with oil. Anyway, so I'm talking to people at this tea estate about what happens when elephants come through. And the elephants often, to get into the stores where like there's a woman who had a store where she sells grain. She's a tea picker, right? And she was talking about the elephant knocked down the wall. I went and I saw the wall had been knocked down, and this had happened a couple times. And anyway, she wasn't angry at the elephants. The elephants aren't killed. The elephants get treated very nicely. But over the course of the day, talking to her and learning from the person I was traveling with about how these people are paid and how they're treated, the tea pickers, she earns 150 rupees a day, which is about the cost of a cup of coffee. And there's a quota, and it's difficult work. They've got a bag that's slung over their forehead, and there's people supervising who are sort of not beating them, but, you know, being sort of aggressive in trying to get them to work faster. I decided to put this into the book, even though it's really, you know, the fact that in India, depending on your caste, your species, your gender, it may be a better place to be an animal than a person. I mean, some of the ways that, you know, people are treated there, and I decided to put that in because it just seemed like it should be mentioned. It didn't have to do with the elephants, really. But yeah, there are definitely moments where you just want to put something in because it should be said.
And how do you approach that? Are you like, I'm going to say this point blank? Or do you say, or are you more like, I'm going to present the color of this so that there's a richness and people can sort of walk away with their own interpretation? Like, how do you approach?
Well, often the latter, but in this, like that? Yeah, mm-hmm. often the latter, but in this case, I did say that. I did say, depending on your caste, gender, species, and I forget what else, economic class, I guess, I don't know, it seems like it may be a better place to be an animal. So yeah, there was this also, there was a, I had come across a article about how they were in Delhi, they were building new sanctuaries for this cattle. You know, cows wander the streets and they're considered sacred, and they're building this facility, this sanctuary, and, you know, talking about how high tech it was and how nice it was. And then they said, and we also have a plan to house some of the elderly with the cows. I was like,
throw them in there too.
Okay.
Wow. Right.
And not to be picking on India. I mean, we have so many problems here. I mean, just I live in California where, you know, the homeless situation is shameful given, you know, how much money in property, just in property tax in the Bay Area. You know, how much money you're getting in the housing prices are so high. How is it that we can't figure this out? How is it that we just all drive by these tent camps and how can this not? Yeah, oh, just saying, we don't, not like we have the answers.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And I, you know, it must be a difficult task grappling with how much do we go to that place that can be confronting, that can be difficult? How much do we stick with, you know, content and topics that are less confronting? You know, how do you find that real mix when you're putting together 80,000 plus words and, you know, what is your goal in your writing? Is it to inform? Is it to entertain? Is it to put people in a position where they're out of their comfort zone and they're sort of looking at the world through a fresh lens? Like, what do you ultimately hope that people will get out of reading your book?
Right. Well, I think, you know, to inform and entertain is always part of it. But for each book, I think there's, you know, and it's something I don't know necessarily when I start a project, because I don't know anything when I start a project. I'm kind of coming at it about as ignorant as you can be, the topic that is. So, but by the end of it, you spend a couple of years and you do have often something that you'd like people to take away from each book. I mean, with Stiff, I just wanted people to kind of understand the value because people tend to be like, ooh, they do these things with cadavers. Oh, it's really disrespectful. It's like, well, actually they're dead and they don't feel pain. So it's this tremendous gift, almost a superpower. And it's a wonderful thing to do. It's incredibly generous. So I just to get people to think about, at the very least, making their organs available. I think it's just so tragic to not to make use of, you know, if you're in a position where your organs could be procured and transplanted, it just seems like such a, because there's so many people waiting. So definitely, you know, wanting people to think through why they are not making their organs available, and maybe even to think about donating their remains, their whole body for research.
Oh yeah. These are huge outcomes. I mean, I can tell you point blank, and maybe I already had this, you know, tendency, and maybe I already had this idea in my mind. But like you said, Stiff came out 20 years ago. I'm 38 years old next month. 20 years ago, I'm at my 20-year high school reunion. I was young, right? I was a high school graduate when Stiff came out.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that I can, you know, it's maybe not single-handedly, but it, one of a very impactful book for me that I ultimately absolutely want to donate my body to science. I absolutely want to give my tissues and my whole self and my, you know, whether it's my arm or my toe or my hair yeah. or my eyeballs or whatever, to help answer some sort of question that may ultimately help others. Yeah, I mean, Stiff was instrumental in that for me, and I bet you there are a lot of other people who could say the same.
Yeah, so I want there to, you know, there's usually some kind of core message that isn't something that I set out to get across, but I think when you write a book, when you spend that much of your time immersed in a subject, That kind of happens naturally. Otherwise, it just feels like a collection of random facts.
Right. And so how would you conceptualize that for Fuzz? I mean, is it the sort of they were here first and they don't have the skills and the parameters that we as human beings have? So we've got to figure out a way to
yeah,
coexist?
I mean, for Fuzz, it's really, first of all, I want people to kind of understand how complex the solutions are, and how, anytime somebody says, why don't you just, you know, make some bear resistant trash containers, you know, like there's a whole chapter on how crazily complicated it is to make that matter, and the problem being humans. So I want people to kind of see that it's surprisingly complex. And also just to, I think when we use the term pest, it enables us to, I mean, first of all, puts the animal in the context of human existence, which isn't right. You know,
yeah, as if they exist just to annoy us or serve us.
Yeah, and I think it also gives us permission to just call somebody to take care of the problem without thinking, what is that like for that animal? And also, you know, to realize there's things that you can do to prevent the problem from happening in the first place. Like maybe don't have a cat door that lets the raccoons come in and eat the cat food, or, you know, maybe, you know, seal up the hole where the squirrel is getting into the attic. Just as the things that you can do. So just trying to get people to think before they act, and to realize just how surprisingly complicated these challenges are. I mean, obviously animals aren't committing crimes, they're following their instincts, but they do all the things that we consider crime, and that we can't just write a ticket, you know, so we have to kind of figure it out.
Tried, as you
yes.
pointed out.
Yeah, exactly. And just to, in the end, realize that if there's any way to just coexist and wait, you know, to coexist smartly in a way that doesn't encourage the animals to become a threat to public safety, because that's when animals like bears get killed.
Yeah, really, it reinforces this idea, at least in Western culture, and especially in really industrialized culture, of how separate we are from our food, from our surroundings, from, you know, from, quote, nature. And we, you know, the example that comes to mind for me, like the very first thing I connected in my head when you were saying what you were saying about pests, was this idea of the garbage that we produce and how we throw things, quote, away. Like they just go away. Yeah. Like away?
Yeah, we threw it away.
We just don't think about it. We think there's this like weird vacuum space-time kind of like wormhole where we drop our stuff in the bin and then it just like flits off into nowhere land.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, no, we're producing garbage and then it's going into a landfill. Like, come on. And it's the same kind of thing, I think, with nature. It's sort of like, oh, it just, you know, it like sorts itself out there.
Right.
And yeah, that's one of the things that I often find, you know, I spend not a fair amount of time, but as much time as I possibly can in Africa specifically. I've spent a lot of time in Southern Africa and more specifically in Namibia. It's one of my favorite places to be. And human wildlife conflict is a topic of great interest to me. And I think a lot of people think that like in Africa, first of all, they think it's a country, not a continent. Second of all, they think that just wildlife just is. They don't realize the amount of management that happens with wildlife, that many of these animals are named, they're tagged, they're numbered, we have a general idea of how many there are, we know who the nuisance animals are. There are literally fences everywhere, and there are, you know, like people think that Africa is just this like wild place.
I remember being at Kruger National Park, which is it's a national park about the size of Massachusetts. I mean, it's huge, but it is still a fenced area. It's a big corral, you know, and I remember being surprised by that, that there was an artificial artificiality, if that's a word.
Yeah.
Like teacherliness.
It works for me, for sure. I think yours actually might be a word. Yeah, mine definitely is not.
I'm going to say teacherliness is a word. I always throw one made-up word into every book.
I love it.
Nobody seems to notice. It's just like, oh, huh, I guess that's a word. Yeah, okay.
Right, as they would say on The Simpsons, that feels perfectly cromulent to me. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating how many things are well known to individuals for whom that is their context and are so utterly foreign for individuals for whom they never are. They either have the privilege or just the frame to never have been exposed to them, to never have thought about them. And I think that's one of the things that your books do so well, is that you manage to just zero in on that thing that makes you go, what? And then really introduce it in a way that is confronting and grappling and funny and sweet and interesting and all those things. That, so that each new chapter, I'm going, no fucking way, as opposed to most books where it's like there's one core thing that's like, wow, that's interesting, let me learn everything there is about it. When I read your books, I'm constantly going, I no way, that's so bananas to me.
People sometimes say, well, how come you didn't write about, like, for Gulp, okay, Adventures on the Alimentary Cow, like you said, it's like mouth to butt along the way, but it's only the really surprising weird shit that I found. There's nothing about, really not very much about nutrition or digestion. I mean, there's something, but it's not like how we, it's not a book about digestion, which people often say, and I get why they're saying that. I'm like, actually, you won't learn really anything about digestion. Nutrition, certainly nothing. You know, I'm just like stuff like, you know, is it ever possible to escape from a stomach if you've been eaten? Does the eaten ever prevail? Like, so I'm, you know, tracing down stories about people, you know, the Jonah story, and like there's a rumor that herpetology people who like have pet lizards and things, that they're like mealworms can eat their way. There's this sort of urban myth that they could eat their way out of a reptile's stomach. And I found
like a bat fly eating its way out of your arm.
Right, exactly. And I'm like, I don't think so. And I actually found this guy's like, you know what? We could attach a string to a mealworm and put an endoscope down the reptile and we can feed it to it and watch what happens. So I'm like, God, I love you. This is great. He was out at University of Nevada. I drove out and he did this. It's just great. I mean, that's one of those, but I get very excited about that. Like, I don't get excited about a beach vacation, but I get pretty excited if somebody's like, we're going to tie a line to a mealworm, live mealworm, and we're going to have the little endoscope in there. We're going to see if it escapes, if it starts to chew through the stomach. It didn't. It just like completely went limp.
Right. Yeah. It just died and then turned into nutrition. And you know what's funny is that my big takeaway from Gulp, if I'm being honest with myself, other than all the cool stuff about self-surgery, that was like probably my favorite and most like, whoa, holy crap, like self-surgery. But probably my biggest takeaway, and it's such a stupid thing, I'm like, how did I not know this? I literally have taught multiple times anatomy and physiology at the university level. But how did I not really think about the fact that that tube, again, from your mouth to your butthole, is not inside of you. It's your outsides.
Yeah. We're like donuts.
Yes. That was my biggest take.
Yeah. That was the thing that got me interested. I was like, this is a really weird place. It's full of bacteria. Anything goes, you know, it's not sterile. It's a complete tube from one end to the other. So we are essentially human donuts. You know, just, and so I was just like, what else is going on in there? Just like, it's a really weird place. Why I called it Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So it'd be kind of like a tour down, you know, down the Danube or something.
Right, the lazy river.
Yeah, exactly. Just you're traveling down the Alimentary Canal, you know, and I remember my publisher going, people don't know what alimentary means. And I was like, well, let them fucking look it up. You know, I think they're going to figure it out by the image on the cover. You know, or they open it up and they look at the table of contents, they'll figure it out anyway.
And I love that too. I love that you have this sort of, you know, one of the things I always say when I'm teaching science communication is, you know, never underestimate the intelligence of your audience, but always underestimate their vocabulary. So this idea that, you know, people might not know specific terms, but I do think part of journalism and part of good writing is to inspire people to look words up, you know, and to help people improve their vocabulary, not to help minimize people's vocabulary.
Exactly. Don't pander to the lowest common denominator. I definitely want to have a couple words that I think most people are not going to know this word, and that's a gift I'm giving them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're going to see it, and maybe they'll look it up, and they'll go, "Oh, that's a great word." You know, and not just a word, not for the sake of it being a big word, but for the sake of it being a really specific, fabulous word. It's like I'm going to use that word.
So I've got to say, okay, so we've only got like a few minutes left, and there's a million other things I could ask you. And I do want to ask you, I ask everybody who comes on my show kind of my famous two questions at the very end, but they're short and sweet. So before I ask those last two questions, I'm just wondering if maybe you can share with us from Fuzz, I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, I sort of even hate asking it, but is there anything, if you had to point to something that like really surprised you, something where you literally came out of your reporting going, I had no idea, and that was bananas. Like, if you had to point to something like that, just to whet people's appetite a little bit, what would it be?
Well, I had no idea that 500 people a year are killed by elephants in India. That was just an utter surprise
for
me.
Wow, that's a lot.
I had no clue that some of the techniques that were used to try to eliminate birds that were either pilfering crops or people thought that they were eating duck eggs so that hunters wouldn't have enough ducks to shoot. So there was this whole era of crow bombing where they would string up dynamite in the roosts while the crows were gone, and then the crows would come back and they'd set. It was just like, and there's all these news stories from the early half of the last century. So that was, you know, I never had heard of that. Also, the second battle for Midway Island, had no clue that the kind of war on albatrosses, which ultimately albatrosses won. The Navy built a naval base, and they were flying planes and refueling. And so it was a busy airstrip, and these are big birds, and they were like, this is dangerous. We've got to get rid of those albatrosses. There was nothing they could try that would convince the albatross to go away. It was just
hell yeah, hilarious, good for those
albatrosses. A hilarious effort. At one point, they brought in these biologists, Hubert and Mabel Frings, and they were like, you know what? We saw some housewives carrying large cloths and that seemed to shoo away the albatrosses. So we think if you could have some of your Navy men walk around with large red pieces of fabric amongst the birds, we think that would work. And then like eventually they sort of stopped talking to Hubert and Mabel. And at one point they tried to trip the albatrosses. Like, we're gonna string wire at a low level across the nesting area so they'll trip.
That's hilarious. I love it so much. People are so dumb. I love
that kind of, thing was just kind of like, wow, I had no idea. I've heard of the battle for Midway, but this is a different battle.
All right. Well, Mary, we're almost out of time. So I was hoping that you would take just a moment to lend us your insights about these two big picture questions that I ask all my guests who come on Talk Nerdy. And when I ask them, I want you to think about them in whatever context is relevant to you. So it could be very personal. It could be about your work, your life, your family, or it could be communal, like community, global, even cosmic, if that's relevant to you. So the first question is, when you think about the future, what is, if you had to pick one thing, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, the thing that literally worries you, that maybe you're a bit pessimistic, even potentially, you know, dare I say, cynical about? And on the flip side of that, where are you finding hope, authenticity, optimism, excitement? What are you looking forward to?
Well, for the first one, I don't even know where to begin. The erosion of democracy, not just in this country, but all over. And I guess the one thing at the core of it is that somehow we've lost truth. That people in politics in particular now feel absolutely free to make things up and just lie, not spin it, not exaggerate, not obfuscate, but just flat out lie. And that it seems to be very difficult for people because we have no agreed upon source. Some people are looking at the news, some people are looking at Fox, which is not news. So that we no longer have something approximating fact and truth. And that once you go down that hill, man, I don't know how you get back out. So I think that right there.
I'm with you 100%. So with that darkness, do you see any silver linings, or is there something that, you know, a little kernel of something that you hold on to that you feel hopeful about?
Yeah, I will say that, okay, I just did a radio show called Coast to Coast AM, which is it's a very kind of bizarre show. It's 3 hours long and it's live. And it's people, there's a lot of conspiracy stuff and UFOs and a lot of what I would call untruths. And it's a call-in show. And so I took the calls. People were calling in. They were sharing stories about wildlife. And they were, but they were really nice, kind, friendly people. And they're people that I know if I looked at their voting record and I looked at various things about them, I would be like, oh my God, this is a person who voted for Trump. But they're people, and people are genuinely nice. And I feel like that is still true. And I feel that we have been so polarized by politics, the media and social media, that we've been manipulated into this us versus them. And every time I get out into the world and I travel in rural areas and I talk to people who have very different lives from me and very different beliefs, they're genuinely nice people. We're all people, and we still are. And so when I do that show, it kind of makes me step back from all of my outrage and all of my, how can they believe this? And how can they do that? They're just nice people. They're very polite. They're very, I don't know. We're all human.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How very humanistic of you. I love it. Well, everybody, her books are, of course, Stiff, Spook, Bonk, Packing for Mars, Gulp and Grunt, and the newest, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Mary Roach, thank you so much for spending your hour with us today. I, as always, had a blast. I learned a lot. I laughed a lot. And I'm so thrilled that you had the time to spend with us.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. Absolutely. It was so lovely to spend more time with you. You know, I think it was an hour that we spent back at the Fashion Institute of Technology.
Yeah, for Nexus, for the New England Conference on Science and Skepticism.
That's what it was. That's right. Yeah. Anyway, lovely to be back in touch. And thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.